This is a paid commercial program and may not represent the views of Bonneville International Corporation or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions from this broadcast are solely those of the individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Obama administration has challenged federal agencies and operations to become more transparent, participatory, and collaborative. The U.S. General Services Administration plays an integral role in making such aspirations real. We'll explore this and more with our guest, David McClure, Associate Administrator, Office of Citizen Services and Communications at the U.S. General Services Administration. Dave, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining our conversation from IBM is Ken Beecher. Ken, welcome.
Thanks.
Let's start off. Could you give us a sense of the history and mission of the General Services Administration?
I'd be glad to. You know, it's an interesting agency in the federal government. It was actually born after the conclusion of World War II. It had responsibilities for disposing of the war surplus, inherited responsibilities for managing a lot of the public buildings, and also began running some of the acquisition processes for government. So it morphed into what it is today. If you see it, GSA today, people think of two things when they think of GSA: public building service. We manage the inventory of public buildings around the country, build, own, lease, manage that. The other big function at GSA has been the acquisition service. So we procure billions of dollars in supplies, services for the federal government centrally to bring some efficiencies to how government makes those purchases. And then we have a wide range of staff offices and smaller offices, one of which is mine in the Office of Citizen Services and Communications. So GSA has quite an interesting footprint in that it's a government-wide type of servicing agency.
Operationally, what's the size of its budget and geographical footprint, if you will?
Well, it has about 12,000 employees, so it's not a small place. We're geographically dispersed all around the country. It's a highly decentralized, very diversified office, has a footprint, obviously, in D.C., but because of the functions of GSA, we're geographically around the country.
Now that you've given us a sense of the larger organization, what about your specific area as the Associate Administrator for the Office of Citizen Services and Communications? What are your specific roles and responsibilities? How is your office organized?
Yeah, it's again another byproduct of some change at GSA. The Office of Citizen Services and Communications was actually created in 2002. It came out of the Office of Government-Wide Policy and was combined with the Office of Communications. So there was a desire to focus on service delivery to citizens. If you remember back in 2001, FirstGov, the first portal for the U.S. government, nationwide portal, was created. That has morphed into USA.gov, as we call it now, and that is a primary responsibility of this office, is to run this electronic front door for the federal government. We actually provide links to state and local governments as well. Where do citizens go to get services for passports, for veterans benefits, for Social Security benefits? How do you get a driver's license renewed? So it's quite a centralized repository of direct contact with citizens and directing them to information and services as efficiently as we possibly can. That's been the cornerstone of that office. We also run the 1-800-FED-INFO, or the National Contact Center for the federal government. Any citizen wants to dial in and ask a question about problem, help, where do I go to get X, Y, or Z, the National Contact Center is there taking phone calls on behalf of the entire federal government and will spin them off to an agency if they need specific help with a process problem or service delivery problem. That contact center lights up during national emergencies, Katrina, any kind of natural disaster, that thing lights up with activity. And we often take on the additional responsibility, like if a FEMA is overloaded with calls, we'll pick up capacity and actually begin answering calls on behalf of these other agencies. Or if they want a emergency contract put in place just to beef up the ability to answer questions, we'll handle that contract for them. And then the third piece of citizen services has been the print distribution center in Pueblo, Colorado. If you ever have ordered a government publication, it will come out of Pueblo, and we run that print publication operation as well.
Well, I just had a follow-up because I wanted to know, what's a day in the life of the associate administrator for this particular
office? Yeah, so running all of that, you know, is very operational, and I don't actually get involved in the day-to-day operational aspects of that. We are redesigning the website, you know, USAGov, so we've been heavily involved in upgrading and thinking about new functionality to add to that. I've asked people in the office to think about integrating information across those three channels of service delivery. So if I call or I contact by web or I get something in writing from the publication center, how do we connect all that information so it's the same information? So that's another piece. The other thing that I've brought into the job is new responsibilities. So we're running a lot of the e-government initiatives on behalf of OMB, which are very much citizen-facing, and trying to move government rapidly into the Web 2.0 new media space. So I have a whole sub-office that I've created that's focused on putting tools in place to get agencies communicating with citizens in dialogues, public interaction sessions. We have an open government directive that's moving government rapidly into transparency. So the office is playing a really critical role in several very high-powered initiatives in that area as well.
Regarding your roles and responsibilities, what are your three top challenges that you face, and how are you addressing these challenges?
Yeah, well, that's a great question, and I had to think about that a moment. When I got into, you know, I was in government for a while, I went to the private sector, I'm back in government, and obviously you go through that period of readjustment because commercial and public sector definitely have similarities, but they have a great deal of differences. So the three challenges I'm faced with every day is matching the right people to the work. Just because they hold a particular position or job doesn't necessarily mean they're the best person for a specific thing that we need to do. You can ask people that work for me. The first thing I did was begin shaking the tree a little bit and moving people around, giving them new opportunities, moving them into different lines of work so that I could capitalize on their interest and their skills and their capabilities. So I think that's a big challenge. The second challenge is managing expectations. There is so much on our plate, and the time frames are very short that we've constantly trying to keep the pace quick, but we also have to manage the expectations of the White House or OMB, our own leadership, on in terms of what we can deliver without overselling, overpromising, so we don't lose confidence. I feel lucky. I think we have a high level of confidence in what we're doing because we move quickly and we have been delivering, so that's a good thing. And the third challenge I've discovered is just the work of government is still so focused on meetings, face-to-face, in the room, around the table, and it is necessary for some things but not necessary for others. So I find the challenge of moving us into this online collaboration and moving us into workflow that's very lightweight, that's problem-solving, get things done, move on, is challenging in government because we're just not accustomed to operating that way.
Well, let's take a quick step back. This isn't your first stop as a public servant. Can you describe your career path for our listeners, and you know, how did you begin your career?
I actually showed up by accident in Washington. I was destined to become a college professor. I had a degree in public policy and public administration. I, at the last minute, applied for the presidential management program, was, you know, went through the interview process and said, well, maybe I should go to Washington and actually get inside of government. And that was in 1983. I liked what I saw. It was very fascinating to be inside the government, actually doing things. I ended up staying at GAO for about 18 years because GAO provides you a snapshot, a view of government that you could get nowhere else. Literally worked on everything from DOD, Intel, to environment, to national parks. I don't think there was any agency or department I really didn't have some insights into from a policy perspective. And then I rapidly saw the intersection between information technology and public policy. In about 1988-89, I went into the information management component of GAO and started running information management and policy reviews. I just found that fascinating work. Created what we called GAO best practices reports. Everybody's used to getting the blue covered reports from GAO, which are scathing, telling you what all your problems are and not happy campers. So I introduced a new series in GAO, the Red Series, which is has nothing to do with auditing. It's going out and finding leading commercial public sector practices and publishing those and then trying to influence legislation, which we did with the Clinger-Cohen Act, trying to influence how OMB carries out its oversight through executives and presidential orders, and then recalibrating the audit evaluation process so that it's focused on a regimented set of principles and practices so that when you went in and evaluated somebody against that, they went, yeah, that makes sense. That's what we should be doing. And you didn't get into this tug of war. So I, you know, stayed at GAO 18 years. I probably could have stayed there my entire government career, but I always said, gee, it would be nice to go on the other side of the fence and maybe see what it's like. And I jumped out to a nonprofit, the Council for Excellence in Government, for a couple of years and ran their e-government program and leadership training. Went over to Gartner as an analyst and then managing the global government research agenda and got to travel around the world, interacting with governments all around the world and learning about our problems in the U.S. were not unique. Everyone in the world actually struggles with a lot of these important IT delivery questions. So at some point in time, somebody knocked on my door and said, would you like to come back in the government? Martha Johnson, the current administrator, and I had breakfast, and she said, would you like to come back in? I was not looking for it. It's just one of those points in time where the roads kind of split. I said, I think that might be cool because I had worked on the transition team for the Obama administration, thought it was a unique period in time. Great opportunity, fast-moving agenda. She said, sure. So back in.
Well, given your wealth of experience, both private and public sector, what makes an effective leader in an increasingly interconnected and networked world?
A good leader is a good listener. I think to be effective in today's environment, particularly as we move more and more to online communication and collaboration, the challenge for a leader in government is actually to be comfortable in that environment, that you allow employees to interact with you directly, that you run open, transparent conversations and meetings, and we don't have a hierarchical chain of command. And so I run a very flat organization. My door is always open to anybody that works for me, from a lowest GS level up to my deputies. And I believe in having that openness in hearing direct feedback, giving advice, setting the tone when necessary. But I think we've moved into a very fluid, agile working environment that requires leaders to pay a lot of attention to the interaction and communications of leadership in a very dynamic way.
What about the Open Government Directive? We will ask David McClure, Associate Administrator of the Office of Citizen Services and Communications within the U.S. General Services Administration when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. From contaminated peanut butter to spinach, our food safety net has shown signs of fraying, with tainted products slipping through to retail shelves, causing human harm and economic ruin. Pick up the latest Center report on food safety and find out how critical private-public partnerships are enhancing the current food safety system in America. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our reports at businessofgovernment.org. What is risk management? How do you manage risk more effectively? How can risk management lead to better decision-making? And what about applying risk management in government? Pick up the Center's report, Managing Risk in Government, An Introduction to Enterprise Risk Management, and find out. This report is especially timely given the Obama administration's focus on accountability and transparency, which has prompted a renewed focus on proper risk management and controls. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is David McClure, Associate Administrator, Office of Citizen Services and Communications at the U.S. General Services Administration. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Ken Beecher. Dave, the Obama administration has called for an unprecedented level of openness in government. Before delving into it all, would you provide us with some context around the principles and characteristics of open government? And how does embracing new technology foster open government?
Sure. Well, this is one of the most important areas for the Obama administration. The president, within 24 hours of office, signed a presidential directive on creating openness and transparency in government. The open government movement is about increasing transparency in government, making itself visible to the average citizen in terms of its operations, its activities, its results. It's about participation, opening up the channels of participation so that citizens can actually interact in a two-way manner with government. It's not a one-way feed of information from government to citizens. Collaboration is another principle of open government, that you allow issues to be brought up, discussed, challenges issued, and some collaboration, some decision-making that's again, in an open, participatory fashion and could perhaps be tailored for different kinds of needs. And the last real principle, I think, of open government is innovation. It's about not standing still. It's about thinking about new ways that you could direct the activities and processes of government to be as innovative as possible, not to go out into unnecessary risk, but be creative, open up for new ideas and new ways of conducting the business of government. And those cornerstones lie behind, I think, everything you see coming out of the White House.
So the issuance of the Open Government Directive has challenged federal agencies to increase, as you said, transparency, participation, and collaboration with the public. Would you delve into a little bit more of the specifics outlined in the Open Government Directive?
Sure. It has some core fundamental things that agencies are expected to do. One is, in the area of transparency, to post or publish high-value data sets. This is a push to get information that has historically been either inaccessible or locked up in government to be put out in the sunshine for everyone to see. We're not talking about taking sensitive or classified or personal identifiable information and putting it out for public consumption. It's just the operational efficiencies of government, the results of programs, the activities of government, the data that it collects, making it as widely shareable and accessible as possible. So that's number one, is just getting data into the public domain. You've seen usaspending.gov created. It gives you a complete overview of the financial situation of government. You see data.gov that's been created, which has hundreds of thousands of data sets that are posted for people to use. The second big piece is openness, and that's creating opportunities for the public to do this interaction. And that's largely being done through the new media or social media tools that we are putting in place. So running open public dialogues where you can either phone or through a web chat interact with government, give ideas, vote on things, react to what other citizens are bringing up and saying that's a great idea. And then taking that interaction and letting it be an input into decisions on what you're trying to do to improve service delivery or the public face of your agency or opportunities to deliver services in different ways that you weren't aware that perhaps the customer base needed. The third piece that's going in place are what we call contests and challenges. And I think this is a really fun piece of open government. It's a fundamental recognition that the best ideas of how to do anything never reside within any single unit, office, or person. That although you may think you know more about something than anybody else on the planet, it's great to kind of get some ideas from outside of the box. So we're setting up challenges and contests to allow citizens and organized groups to actually come up with new proposals on how government could deliver a service or build a new way to organize and use information or actually develop a product. You know, NASA, for example, is interested in great advance in technologies. Why not, instead of just competing it through a procurement process, ask industry, give us your best shot at the next spacesuit we ought to be using to go into deep space. What would it look like? How would it function? And just throw it open to a contest for open competition. And the product that's delivered becomes government property. It's a fascinating and quite different model than everything going through a competitive procurement and acquisition model. And it's groundbreaking, and not everything is suited for this, but I think some things are. I'll just give you a real simple example. We're encouraging agencies to do video contests. So we've run one on USA.gov, the portal. We said, we're redesigning this site. Give us your ideas on what you think you would like to find on that site that's not there. And then if you are finding the site useful, submit a video. Tell us how you use the site. Be creative. We had over 30 videos submitted that are unbelievable on how citizens filmed themselves and showed how they were using the information on USA.gov. We gave the video contest winner $2,500. not a huge sum of money, but, you know, it's an incentive. And we have a equivalent of 30 public service ads, actually, because these are all public and they're on YouTube and they're being played 24 hours a day. So it's like free advertising for us about USA.gov. So it's a great example of how innovation and creativity can be put into place in ways that we used to not think were possible.
That really gets the message out.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dave, will you tell us more about GSA's efforts conducting public dialogues for federal agencies? I mean, you mentioned social media tools. I mean, specifically, what tools are you using, what have been used, and share some of the key results.
Sure. There's a plethora of tools or software applications that are permeating throughout the market right now. It's a really exciting time to be able to go into a almost untapped marketplace. You have companies that are popping up every day that are creating new applications and new ways to do things in the social media space. Most of them are very small. They don't do any business with the government. They actually are producing their product in a very quick fashion. So we're taking advantage of that. There's certainly products for sale as well. But in the spirit of trying to find no-cost, agile tools that are on the marketplace, we've actually launched two things. One, we conducted some market research and found a dialogue tool that was no charge to the government. We said, rather than every agency going out and buying or securing its own tool, why don't we find one that basically meets the needs that we see of government? We will do the policy lift, the security review, the privacy assurances. We would stand that up. And we would allow the agencies to basically use the tool free of charge, no cost. GSA spent, you know, under $10,000 to do anything to the tool, just to make it useful in by putting some branding on the of each agency. We ran a 5-week dialogue. We had over 2,000 ideas, 20,000 votes across the entire government, new ideas, proposals for how those agencies could actually be more transparent. So we did it for virtually no charge at all. That's unprecedented. We're doing the same thing in the challenge contest. There's lots of tools out there to run challenges, but we think agencies need to just learn how to punt, pass, and kick. And so we found a very inexpensive, no-cost tool. Doesn't handle all complex challenges and contests, but we think it's a basic tool that you could launch something with to learn more about it. Same model. We do all the policy, security, technical lift, turn it over to the agencies free of charge, let them put their own brand name on their web page. So you're putting a government-wide solution in place, which when we tried to do that in the past in the government, it was fought to death. When you offer it for free, people kind of get more interested in it. And when it's a quality product, I mean, we do the assurances that it works, it handles basic functionality. You're not violating any security policies. All that's been taken care of for you. It's an attractive model. So we want to do more of that to create a runway of rapid adoption of the tools.
Right. And you mentioned the votes and the ideas that came out of this tool. So what happens next with those ideas and votes?
Yeah, and that's a great point. So, you know, one of the other things that we did is rather than just turn this into a tool selection, running public dialogues involves knowing how to moderate dialogues. It's just like having a conversation here. You can't just launch a web page and say, well, come online and give us your ideas. It's not an attractive enough honeypot. So we actually took between 150, 200 people out of the agencies and trained them as moderators on how to be effective web moderators with these online tools. And that's a secret of success, is that you actually used it as a two-way dialogue rather than a static posting of just ideas. So that's very important. Second thing is, well, what do you do with it? The kiss of death in this area is if you run a dialogue, you open this up for massive participation, you take all these ideas in, and then you kind of like pull the shade down and say, see you later. So the thing we're trying to emphasize to agencies is as they constructed their open government plans, as they put their roadmaps in place for running dialogues and challenges and being more transparent, show how you've taken that dialogue, those ideas, those high vote getting suggestions, and put them in your plan. And if you go online, you'll see in several agencies, they'll have a banner on their open government page that basically says, "We listened to you." And they will actually map what came out of the dialogue in terms of top ideas to things they've put directly into their roadmap of initiatives. That, to me, is, you know, what you have to do to be legitimate in this space.
Right. So we have these open government plans, and we know President Obama's need for transparency and accountability. So, you know, what are some of the barriers keeping federal agencies from using social media tools?
First of all, it's brand new. You are engaging your customers in a real way. This is not a survey. It's not a town hall. This is largely being done with internet technology. So it's very live, very real, very quick. The unknown is what will come in. That scares agencies. You know, you're opening yourself up for the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think that's just a culture that we have to go through in the openness and transparency space, that you want legitimate feedback. You don't want to sugarcoat things. You know there'll be controversy coming out of it. I think we just have to live through that. The other is concerns about privacy and security. You know, this is an online public dialogue. What assurances can the government give to a citizen that when they go on to one of these dialogues that we're not collecting information, tracking their responses? You know, this is not Big Brotherville going on. And, you know, we've put all the assurances in place that we don't have that capability and we're not empowering that capability. And we're protecting privacy in every way that we can. We're interested in the ideas, the suggestions, and the conversation, not who you are. So that's important. I think the other thing is that, and we saw this take place, quite honestly, I'll be frank with you, in the open dialogue that went on for the 5-week period, there are obviously people that can get online and they will log in 5,000 times and they will plant the same idea over and over and over again because they know it will rise to the top and be a legitimate way to game the system. So there are ways you can obviously prevent that from happening through some software configuration and rules that you put in place. You can also have somebody that's actively monitoring the interaction going, well, this guy's getting on and on and on, so you stop it. You know, so it's just like anything else. You've got to manage it, and you've got to be aware of what some of those sensitivities
are. Right,
so
you mentioned education as one of the ways to break down those barriers. What other type of means are you using?
A lot of it's education and training. I think it's a show me from Missouri thing. You've got to actually do some of this and show that risks are real, but they can be managed. You've got to show that there's a value proposition coming from the dialogue and the open participation, that it's not just a quagmire of a huge tsunami of comments coming in that overwhelm you and you have no idea what to do. So I think we've learned that the tools and the processes for managing that intake are very critical to actually show some value from this kind of approach.
You're mentioning the contest challenges and the eventual prize of $2,500 within the video contest. Can you take us through the approach? I mean, how does somebody within GSA say, hey, I think I have a great idea to propagate throughout, you know, GSA or throughout internal, external, you know, stakeholders? How do they go about within GSA to do that?
Yeah. Well, a lot of it is done through traditional means. Somebody will just send an email or go into a staff meeting and say, I just went online. I saw this really cool video contest. We should do the same thing. So a lot of it's just looking at what's happening in the social media space and looking at success in the commercial sector and opening it up to application in the government. I think what we'll eventually do is have, through our collaboration tools, open channels for these kinds of ideas just to pop up and be considered and acted on with a very quick, seamless process. When we ran the video contest, it was largely a decision on our part within OCS. You know, I didn't have to take it up through GSA. We didn't have to go over to the White House. We didn't have to go anywhere to say, can we do this? We're empowered to do it. Agencies are empowered to do these things with this directive. So that's another cool thing about it. It's not what you have to seek permission to do. It's actually you have a big blanket of permission given to you in this area. And that's where I think the innovation and creativity juices get flowing as a result of that.
So, Dave, you've mentioned and established your efforts to establish citizen engagement platforms.
Mm-hmm.
I'm interested and curious, what role does the Center for New Media and Citizen Engagement play in both helping federal agencies with the use of social media tools?
One of the things that we really have acknowledged is this rapid movement into social media, new media space, the use of wikis, blogs, contests, all kinds of tools to actually have interaction with. We have decided that it's such an important area that we want to try to facilitate the adoption of this government-wide. So GSA always thinks in terms of assisting the rest of government with moving into this space. So we've identified some common tools in the wiki, the blog area, posting of pictures, generic collaboration-type tools. We've identified 7. We've actually walked them again through a policy and compliance process, and we're ready to stand these up free for any agency to use. We think it's a way of increasing the velocity of adoption. So the agencies can see these tools are GSA certified, they've run through policy compliance, it's hosted, all I got to do is plug in. So they don't have to go through all of that. That changes the value proposition. And it increases, I think, the interest in the use of the tools, even if it's just for a pilot or something, just to get that figured out. So our Office of New Media and Citizen Engagement, that's their role, identify tools that are very useful in the social media space, to run education and training to help people get up to speed, to provide tools, templates, and best practices that agencies can actually glom onto, pull back from, and actually use them in making decisions on how they want to use social media. It's not a technology issue. It's really understanding, what am I really trying to engage or collaborate about? And then making decisions about the best way to make that happen.
That's a perfect segue, because that involves change in how you handle doing things differently. So a question: with any major or any set of major initiatives comes change. For government agencies, and the citizen engagement is a new concept. So would you elaborate on some of the significant barriers you've seen and how you've overcome them?
The barriers, I think, are internal to government and external to government. The internal barriers are that you're creating a much more open environment for problem solving, decision making, and service delivery. So it goes back to the point I was making earlier. Inside of government, we've created program offices that basically operate and run programs and deliver information and services. We have, from time to time, poke these offices and executives to reach out to their customer base to see, is it working? Is it providing effective service? Open government and delivering things through the web and getting this real-time feedback really exposes yourself to a completely different dynamic with your customer base. It allows people to say exactly what's working and not working. You can argue that maybe people aren't telling the truth, but we feel like it's pretty much a truth serum test back to the agency on truly what is working. You're being transparent about your delivery. So if I'm a veteran and I have to wait 18 months for a particular health intervention, for a certain type of doctor's visit, or to get glasses, or whatever, if I'm transparent about how long that's taking, you better bet that, you know, I think you'd get government focused on trying to resolve the problems with getting that process fixed. So that's what we're trying to do, is to elevate the transparency. And it's going to create a lot of friction inside of government, because managers will actually now have to pass a much tougher accountability test for results. It's not results just within the government, where we're sharing these with the Office of Management and Budget or the White House or with the cabinet secretaries, and we go, here's a bad score and a good score. We're now posting this right out on the web for everybody to see. So the accountability bar goes up tenfold in terms of trying to show that you're taxpayer dollars being spent on program X is actually resulting in good service. So it's a game changer, I think.
What is GSA doing to be more open and collaborative? We will ask David McClure, Associate Administrator, Office of Citizen Services and Communication at the U.S. General Services Administration, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The term cloud computing is suddenly everywhere, with government leaders, industry executives, and the press all talking excitedly about this new concept. Moving to the Cloud, an Introduction to Cloud Computing in Government by David Wild examines both the interest in and the technology surrounding cloud computing, and why it is receiving such increased attention. It tackles such questions as, what is cloud computing? What are some of the top challenges facing government leaders pursuing cloud computing strategies? You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. As society has become increasingly dependent on information technology in government, business, and in our personal lives, safeguarding private information created or shared on computers or the internet has taken on greater significance. How do you keep information secure in an increasingly interconnected and networked world? What is cybersecurity? Pick up the latest Center report, Cybersecurity Management in States, and find out. You can order or download a free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is David McClure, Associate Administrator, Office of Citizen Services and Communications at the U.S. General Services Administration. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Ken Beecher. Dave, we've spoken about GSA's efforts in leading government-wide activities requiring of the Open Government Directive. I'd like to shift a little bit from the external government-wide situation to what GSA is doing internally to become more transparent, more collaborative, and more accountable.
Absolutely. Well, just like every other agency, we have to put up high-value data sets. We have put up a lot of information about the federal procurement process, about the federal open public records meetings that occur so that citizens can get access to that. So we're sifting information about public buildings, historical, architectural things that the citizenry might find interesting. So we're doing the same thing any other agency would be doing. What is it that we don't make publicly accessible that would be something that a citizen should actually have access to? Or if we are making it available, a great example of this Federal Register, postings of all the federal procurement opportunities in the government. Well, if you went online a year ago, you'd get this blinding list of procurement opportunities. And so it's informative. It tells you what's there. If you go to a new website now, you will actually be presented the information by commodity, by topic, however way you want it, and it will geographically also tell you in your region what the contract opportunities are in your area, graphically displayed on a map. So it's just turning information and twisting it to make it more visually pleasing, graphical, interactive in a way that can provide value. So we're doing that. We are also rapidly infusing collaboration tools within GSA. Martha Johnson, our administrator, is a huge believer in the use of technology in running and managing organizations. So we are putting collaboration tools in place so that management as well as employees can exchange ideas on a real-time basis, problem solve, and move more in a more agile fashion around particular issues that we're trying to get agency-wide input on. So that's another step. I'll give you another example. In the procurement process, we have run a public dialogue under the Better Buy program that allowed industry and citizens to actually go online and tell GSA what they thought needed to be done to make the procurement process and services of GSA work even better for them. So we're doing everything any other agency is trying to do, and that's be more interactive, more transparent, more collaborative, and more participatory in nature.
So, I mean, David, you talked a little bit about skill sets and aligning skills or realigning skills when it comes to transformation and change. How does GSA's Web University factor into these efforts?
Yeah, it's a great point. I'm glad you brought it up. I meant to bring it up earlier as well. Web Manager University is a hidden gem in the federal government. It started off with less than 100 people 10 years ago. There are now almost between 2,500 and 3,000 web managers around the entire federal government that belong to what we call Web Managers University. It's a good example of an informal structure being created to capitalize on collective wisdom, problem solving, and just getting things done. This group gets things done. They're not about policy. They're about actually doing it. I'll give you a great example. Craig Newmark, who runs Craigslist, was over at the White House on an industry day with the president's chief advisors. He was asked a question in one of the sessions I was in on what could the public sector, what could government do to actually adopt commercial practices faster and get more innovative. And he said, you have one of the most innovative creative groups already in place. It's called the Web Managers University. He said, I have been on their site. I have interacted with them. He actually comes and speaks at our events. These people are energized. They're problem solvers. So if you want input, he was telling back the White House, if you want input on whether a policy makes sense or not, these are the folks you need to be asking because they're on the ground building the infrastructure of government and delivering information to citizens. So I think Web Manager University is just a fantastic model in terms of how we can not over-engineer government interaction and just create a great network. Our challenge will now be to move that into an online environment, to move it out of the web manager space and start incorporating new media directors, start incorporating program managers so that we create a dialogue across these skill sets and groups in government about new media, openness, transparency. That'll be our challenge going forward.
Right. I thought you just provided a great example of somebody who you're working with externally to help with the government. And I know that GSA has been working with OMB on a number of transparency initiatives, such as data.gov and IT dashboard. So that stuff's been out. So can you share some of the results or the impact to the public and what the public's been using with those?
Absolutely. I think data.gov is, you know, even though it's it'll be celebrating its first birthday soon, that in itself is a comment. It's only 1 year old. So for a year's worth of work, the government has loaded an enormous amount of information onto data.gov. The other thing we're seeing is that other countries around the world have copied data.gov and have put in similar models. Some have actually even surpassed us in terms of the amount of information they put up. But I think it's a good example of delivering on the promise of transparency. So you can talk about it, but at the end of the day, you have to deliver. So we have enormous volumes of data sets that are out there. Our challenge with data.gov is turning it into something that's even more useful. There's obviously a lot of raw data out there that you could pull in and manipulate and analyze and use for purposes of your own. There are some tools that are on that site that can help you navigate the data and make sense of it. A great example of this is a mashup tool that's out there on data.gov. So if I want to know how my city or community ranks in terms of employment, education, pollution, healthcare, I can actually take the data of data.gov with a simple interface on a webmash tool, create my own dashboard of how my city compares. Now, that's just taking a lot of government information on health, environment, and putting it into a way, into a format that's sensible to me that I could actually make use of it. So I think we're learning the value proposition pretty rapidly of that.
Yeah, let me ask a quick follow-up to that. So right now you're talking about data.gov version 1.0.
Yeah.
Right. What does 2.0 look like?
Well, I think 2.0 will be an enriched data set. You know, we've moved an enormous amount of geospatial data into data.gov. I think what we have to do is enable the information in a geospatial capacity, because I might be interested in national information about topic X. Having run USA.gov, citizens want it within the context of where they live. I need to be able to geographically and geospatially connect citizens to their questions involving healthcare, education, veterans, benefits, Social Security, to where they live. And I think that will be 2.0, will be much more geospatially enabled. I think toolkits will get beefed up. I can guarantee you that we'll start running contests using data.gov as the repository of creating new high-value applications for government data. So I don't care whether the government builds the applications. If somebody out there wants to build them on the commercial side, it's the use of the information that we want to see enriched. And I think that's what we'll see with 2.0 as well.
Dave, you're also involved in implementing OMB's government-wide cloud computing strategy. What is cloud computing? And more importantly, what role does your office play in facilitating the use via apps.gov and other avenues?
Right. Cloud computing, you know, is the new fad. Some say it's nothing new. It's really old stuff repackaged. It is a different type of computing model in which you're really taking the power of the internet and the connectivity of the internet, and you're creating ability to store and process and compute information irregardless of my concern about its physical location. And I'm doing it in a fashion that's very elastic. I can actually ask for more services or downgrade my services and have pricing adjusted very dynamically that way. There are several tenets to cloud computing in its purest sense. What I find is that it's just like talking about the economy and what affects the job rate and the inflation rate. Cloud computing lies in the eyes of the beholder. But we are moving in this direction. In a general sense, cloud computing offers enormous economies of scale advantages for the government. It gets us out of several things. One is running huge infrastructure. We began using the infrastructure of the internet to run a lot of our data storage and computational and distribution needs for information. We don't have to own and buy software. We can actually use it as a service, which is, just creates a whole new computing model for us. So my role has been from day one entering in. I was sort of parachuted behind the lines, and I didn't wear a big cloud hat, but I dealt with cloud computing quite a bit at Gartner. So I immediately went in and started helping Vivek in terms of strategy and ideas, and the apps.gov storefront design and where that should be going. So I've kind of played an advisory role. Right now, that function, there's a cloud PMO project management office that's now reporting to me. So I am trying to operationalize the cloud strategy of the federal government. And that's really what GSA's role is. It's to deliver operationally what we want to do in government. Policy, strategy, I can sit in on that. But at the end of the day, I'm trying to think about how we can actually move this into adoption and operationalize cloud computing. So we're behind the apps.gov storefront. We'll be announcing soon several new processes to support cloud computing. One around security, try to make sure that we have a good cloud security approach in government. And we're working with NIST on interoperability and portability standards, which are key to the adoption of cloud as well. We're playing the role of, again, facilitating and trying to get these things moving so that we can help agencies adopt them as quickly as possible.
Right. And you were talking actually about the acquisition of cloud platforms or cloud services. You know, tell us again, back to social media, how are you using social media to improve this acquisition process? So before, you talked a little bit about Federal Registry that made it more user-friendly and intuitive, and talked about Better Buy. So I'm just curious as far as what other, you know, how else are you using collaboration, and how is industry reacting to the use of collaboration? Because we talked a lot about how internally changes within GSA and other agencies. How's industry taking that?
Yeah, well, I think it's a new model for industry as well, because you're opening, first of all, the process up. We've opened the marketplace up, if you will, to both competitive for fee services, and obviously we're also interested in no-cost solutions, which has raised the bar for open source solutions, open APIs, to look at something that can be widely shared across government without huge concerns over licensing. So I think that's caused industry to, you know, step back and say there's more than one model of going through a procurement process to get some of the social new media tools in place. At the end of the day, as long as we keep the new media tools focused on active interaction and dialogue with industry on what they would like to see changed in the process of government in the open government area, that we're doing marching in the right direction.
Dave, you've outlined very clearly the mandates of the Open Government Directive and its focus on transparency. The question I have is regarding the balance between transparency and privacy security. How do you balance the need to know, the need to be open, with the need to be secure?
It is a tug and pull that's going on. We saw it immediately in the recovery effort. The desire to be as transparent as possible about where money is going, how it's being spent, and increasingly what the results are. But sensitive proprietary information about contracts, issues about whether data accuracy and reconstitution of data, if it's lost, issues. So there's this tug and pull. You know, the transparency piece raises the privacy bar. We have to be extremely careful about what we post publicly, that it's not intertwined with sensitive, classified, personal identifiable information. That's a real challenge in government. I think, you know, there's a whole new emphasis on discovery, looking at what we're putting online and trying to make sure that we've cleansed it the best way possible. Mistakes are going to be made, honestly, not purposely. We've already had examples of it. And, you know, the mentality I'm trying to plant in the people I deal with in the agencies is to recognize that you could stand back and just not do anything for fear of privacy concerns, which I think is the way we were operating in the past, or you can be aggressive and say, I will make sure there are controls and processes to check for these things. I know we want them to be as solid as possible, but when an accidental release of information occurs, I'd rather see an agency executive stand up and say, absolutely, bad thing, here's what we've done to fix it so it will never happen again, rather than worrying about being on the front page as being the driver behind why we don't want to be more transparent in government. So I think we have to change the culture of accepting the risk, stepping up to the problem, fixing it so it does not occur, and being proactive rather than reactive. And that's a big change in government.
What does the future hold for open government efforts? We will ask David McClure. Associate Administrator, Office of Citizen Services and Communication at the U.S. General Services Administration, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. Management of government projects, programs, and portfolios, and the related expenditures of public funds are major visible areas of interest and concern. Despite a growing stream of successful program and projects, failures continue at an alarming rate. Pick up the latest Center report, Project Management and Government, An Introduction to Earned Value Management, and find out how this powerful methodology can make your projects more successful. You can order or download a free copy of this and all of our Center reports at businessofgovernment.org. Whether it's the federal government's role in emergency management, its efforts in making operations more sustainable, responsible, and efficient, or the challenges being faced and innovations being forged by local governments during difficult economic times, the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine offers timely, relevant, and thoughtful perspectives on all of these issues from leading practitioners and public managers. Hi, I'm Michael Keegan, Managing Editor of the Business of Government magazine. And we know it's all about making connections, introducing our readers and connecting them to the work of government executives who are leading agencies or initiatives that are focused on critical missions, missions important to them. In our latest edition of the Spring 2010 Business of Government magazine, we bring you conversations with FEMA Administrator Craig Fugate, who talks to us about the challenges facing his agency. Michelle Moore, Federal Environmental Executive, outlines sustainability efforts and greening federal operations. And Robert Doerr, Commissioner of the New York City Human Resources Administration, sheds light on how his agency is doing more with less. Our forum is dedicated to exploring ways government leaders and all leaders can make better decisions. All of this and so much more in the Spring 2010 edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org and find out how the business of government is not business as usual. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm your host, Michael Keegan, and our guest today is David McClure, Associate Administrator, Office of Citizen Services and Communications at the U.S. General Services Administration. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Ken Beecher.
David, please share with us efforts to create awareness campaigns to better educate government employees about the importance of open government and the opportunities and challenges of using social media.
Well, I think it's being done different ways. We chatted earlier about Web Manager University. There's a lot of seminars and training that's done through Web Managers University that we are expanding out the offerings in that space to be very new media, social media oriented. I think I can't tell you with absolute clarity around the numbers, but Sheila Campbell, who runs the Web Manager University, has expanded the curriculum already to be very much focused on this collaboration, participation, and new media space. So we've added classes, we've added seminars, we actually have added events where we're bringing in speakers, both public sector and private sector, to talk about the opportunities and what you can do with social media tools and the challenges that are there as well. I think the other vehicle is the Open Government Working Group. There is a working group that's been created across the entire federal government, two levels actually, one executive level and one working group level. Those folks meet pretty regularly, and one of the objectives of that working group is to share best practices, what's being learned, just, you know, an open dialogue about things. And that's a good vehicle for actually spreading and educating widely.
Dave, I'd like to transition to the future now. Could you give us a sense of the major opportunities and some of the challenges you envision your office encountering in the next couple of years? And given your perspective, what emerging technologies hold the most promise for enhancing your efforts going forward?
Well, you know, I think we'll be challenged in this velocity game of trying to just continue to deliver effective solutions on a government-wide basis. So we're working on some very interesting projects right now. One is called FedSpace, in which we're trying to create a collaboration platform across the entire federal government. So rather than creating a collaboration space just within NASA or USDA or Interior, we want to create a platform that allows government employees to communicate with each other across the entire government. I think it's game-changing because it just opens up ideas, thinking, communities of practice, just completely different way of operating. I oftentimes cannot reach somebody now because I don't know their email address. I've lost their phone number, or they've moved and it's changed. If we have an online collaboration tool, we can connect people in government instantaneously, permanently, and create value propositions around those relationships in ways that I don't even know if we can truly appreciate that completely right now. Create a wiki space, create blogs, create some lightweight workflow so that I could actually organize something online, get some work done, and get value out of it without tremendous amount of effort being put into it. So I think those are real challenges for us, or some of these new initiatives. We're also working on a citizen services dashboard. We're trying to take what would be meaningful performance data of government to a citizen, not to confuse it with program evaluation measures, but if I'm a citizen, what is it that would tell me that government's actually being effective? So we're trying to take operational measures of government. How long does it take to get a tax return? How long does it take for me to get a Social Security disability claim resolved? How long do I have to stand in line at an airport in order to clear security? What's the average wait time? And is it going up? Is it going down? And what's being done about it? So we want to move some of this transparency into the performance arena, but translate it into things that the average person would find some utility in. And I think that's going to be key for us in terms of challenges. One of the biggest technology challenges going forward is analytics. I think we have actually moved into, finally, we're moving into the age of information management. We've created or are creating more of a tsunami of information and data. We've got to be able to sift and sort and analyze and get value out of this information because it's a gold mine. So I think the analytical space is going to be the space where CIOs and IT departments are going to be asked to step up and figure out a little bit more coherently knowledge management, business intelligence, proactive problem solving that's ahead of the curve rather than behind the curve, moving from compliance and reporting to active use of information to really do jobs in a good way. That's going to be a real challenge for us going forward technology-wise.
As you reflect on your career in public service, what advice would you give those considering possibly pursuing a career in public service?
I believe, and I guess the reason why I'm back is I'm a big proponent of public service and career in government. I think if you look at the government, we oftentimes focus on the difficulty of getting a government job and the bureaucracy of government, and we focus on the sort of the ho-hum negative aspects of it. The government creates an enormous opportunity pool of challenges for employees. So if I were somebody coming out of school and I could go to work at someplace like NASA, working on the next deep space strategies, if I could go to work at NIH looking at the most recent and most game-changing medical research technology, if I could go to work making sure the national parks of this country were up to speed and preserved, there's so many meaningful things that government does. If I come in, I can actually provide a real challenge for an employee to deliver a complicated and sometimes very difficult program implementation, but it's unique. You won't be able to find those kinds of experiences anywhere else. And I think it provides, actually, having been in the private sector, my time in the public sector gave me skills that allows me to compete with anyone on the commercial side. I mean, it's the same skill sets of knowing how to problem solve, get things done, organize people, lead efforts. We have those opportunities out the kazoo in government. We just need to step up our imaging and branding and the opportunities that government presents to people that actually want to have challenging jobs. We have a lot of them.
That's wonderful advice. Thanks for joining us today.
But absolutely.
More importantly, Ken and I would like to thank you for your dedicated service to the country.
Thank you so much. My pleasure being here.
Great. This has been the Business of Government Hour, featuring a conversation with David McClure, Associate Administrator of the Office of Citizen Services and Communications at the U.S. General Services Administration. My co-host from IBM has been Ken Beecher. Be sure to join us next week for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government effectiveness. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
This has been the Business of Government Hour. Be sure to join us every Saturday at 9 a.m. and visit us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. There you can learn more about our programs and get a transcript of today's conversation. Until next week, it's businessofgovernment.org.
What is the Federal Aviation Administration's information technology strategy? How is the FAA enhancing its IT governance and program management? And what about FAA's Next Generation Initiative? Join host Michael Keegan next week as he explores these and other questions with Dave Bowen, Assistant Administrator for Information Services and Chief Information Officer at the Federal Aviation Administration. That's next week on the Business of Government Hour.